Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. We're delighted you're here. Thank you very much for coming. This is the kickoff on what we hope is a very big program, and we want all of you to be a part of it. When I first met with our team, and they're going to be leading this discussion today, I said, if America needs to discover an agenda that the rest of the world wants to follow, it's going to be coming by the young people that invent it. And that's what this project's about. So the project is to try to come up with a leadership agenda for America and get 100,000 people to want to follow it. And that's what you're all going to be here to help us with. To get this kicked off, I reached into I owe lots of things to General Colin Powell, but I thought, well, one more time. I'll try one more time. And contacted him. I was rather confident he may say yes on this. Now, let me explain why. I don't know how many of you have read his autobiography. He tells this remarkable story when he and Alma were driving from New York down, I think it was to Fort Jackson. And it was back in a time when America was still a very racially divided and segregated nation and had to endure the indignities of being a black man who was going through the South to find his military post where he could serve his country. Pretty remarkable story when you think about it. Now, he persisted. Now, it tells you several things about the content of his character. A remarkable perseverance and a determination to prevail against odds that the rest of us would give up if we confronted it. But also, I think, a vision that there is hope when you think that it's hopeless. And the other little story I would tell about General Powell is when he left office, he could have done lots of things, but he decided to create an organization called America's Promise. And it was his effort to create a program that would reach out and help a lot of the kids that need help to get started, that have great potential in life, but need that little bit of a lift to get there. And America's Promise was for that. And that was how this general decided to commit himself when he left office. It's a remarkable thing. We're lucky to have this kind of leadership. It's an exemplar leadership. It's the sort of thing that America needs. So I can't say anything more that would amplify on this remarkable personality who's chosen to come here today to help us inspire, I hope, all of you to create an agenda for America. So, without further delay, General Colin Powell. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you all very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Well, thank you very much, John, for that kind and generous introduction. It's a great pleasure to be back at CSIS and to be with an old and good friend like John Hamry, and especially to have the opportunity to kick off this fantastic new effort that talks about the next America, a new vision for America's future, vision that's going to emerge from the young people around the world. But I had to pinch myself. They want to talk about the next generation and the young people of America, and they reach back and get an old geezer. my sell-by date is gone. Here I am anyway. And I said to myself, well, what are you going to talk to these young people about? What can you really tell them, you old analog guy? These are all digital experts. They know all about these fascinating technologies. They know all about Google and Wikipedia and YouTube and all these other fascinating things which allow the world to connect in a way that was unimaginable just a few years ago. And I gave it a great deal of thought and said, I got a lot to say to them. Because I have, in my older age now, as I am in my 70s, become a digital person. I am not the analog person of a few years ago. I am now totally digital. I am digital because of my grandchildren. My grandsons are digital, my little granddaughter is digital, and the 1.5-year-old one is becoming digital. The most digital one is the 14-year-old who plays this thing with the guitar. You know this guitar thing? Yeah. The old people are not smiling. They don't know what I'm talking about. But I watch him, and I realize that he has been hardwired digital since he was a baby. And I still remember when Brian was about a year old, my daughter-in-law, Jane, to entertain him, would put him in front of one of these newfangled things called a laptop computer. And rather than have pull toys in his crib or his playpen, he just sat in front of this laptop computer. And he would watch the screensaver. You know the flying toasters? You remember the flying toasters? And Brian would just sit there all day watching the flying toasters. And then when he was about 14 months old or so, he threw his hand out and hit the keyboard. And the flying toasters went away. Information was there. Information. And within a few months, he was using that computer even before he could actually speak. He was able to use this computer. That's your generation, or the generation just a few years behind you. A generation that is hardwired digital, a generation that understands the power of the information revolution and how it is transforming the world. A generation that you represent, and you're coming together to share, to debate, to decide, to connect with each other, shows what is possible in this information-driven world. What kind of a world is it going to be? What kind of vision are you going to come up with over this period of time that you're going to be talking to one another digitally and in person? What kind of vision do we need? One of the Poopsies says you're going to come up with a grand strategy. Well, we'll see. It's more important that rather than coming up with a grand strategy, that you just bring in not only 100,000, but many hundreds of thousands of young people to come in to this system, to this project, and share their desires, their goals, their anxieties, their fears. What kind of a world do these young people, you young people, want to shape and want to create? And how will you prepare yourselves to be the leaders of this world? And what message do you want to give to your elders in January when this project is completed and you are presenting the results of it to the new leadership of the United States of America and to the new Congress that hopefully we'll hold hearings on this project so you can share what you have learned? What kind of vision will you come up with? I think it's going to be an exciting project and a powerful one. And I think it's going to be something quite different than just reading today's newspapers. When I was your age so many, many years ago, I graduated from college 50 years ago last month. What are you going to do? And the world was quite different. The world was a very analog world. It was a world with two colors, red and blue, the red side of the map and the blue side of the map. It was a world where our very existence was being threatened by powerful forces that emerged after World War II. A Soviet empire behind an iron curtain, a Chinese empire behind a bamboo curtain. And for most of my adult life, for most of my military career, except for the last few years when things all changed, my role was to help our nation contain these forces that were against us. And I was privileged to end my career as a soldier at the time the Cold War came to an end. And I watched the Soviet Empire disappear. I watched the Iron Curtain come down. I watched all my old battle positions along the Iron Curtain at the Fulda Gap go away. I watched China emerge and change. I watched China and the Soviet Union both realize that power in the new age does not come out of the barrel of a gun as it used to, as they thought it would. Instead, power comes from other places and has other purposes. Power comes from the power of your economy. Power comes from the success of your economy. Power comes from the human potential in your populations. As the Iron Curtain came down and all those Eastern European nations became free, there was an explosion of intellectual energy. There was an explosion of people who wanted to start reshaping their countries. When China realized that it had over a billion people who were going nowhere as a people, and when Deng Xiaoping finally said, I no longer care if it's a black cat or a white cat, as long as it catches mice, when he said, I no longer care whether it's capitalism or communism or socialism as an economic model, the only thing that counts, does it create wealth? So the first message I have for you youngsters is that the most powerful force that will be driving the future that you're going to be studying, the vision you have to focus on, is an economic force. People are creating wealth all around the world. China, Eastern Europe, Europe, Latin America, we see it coming up. Even in Africa, you set aside Darfur, and Zimbabwe, and there are many African countries that are now on this path to wealth creation. It's the largest wealth creation era in the history of mankind. Wealth that can be used to make some extremely wealthy, but more importantly, wealth that can be used to solve the problems of the world, the problems of poverty, the problems of hunger, the problems of a lack of clean water, the problems having to do with inadequate health care, the problems of no housing. And these countries that are coming out from behind this red and blue map that I started out in 50 years ago are now on a broad mosaic, a mosaic that's been created by open trading patterns, a mosaic that's been created by the power of the information revolution, the revolution that you're going to be using to do your work, where now information, education, opportunity, capital, risk, and knowledge and transparency exist throughout the world because of cameras that are digital and that can look at everything and send it all over the world. We see this in our daily lives. We see this in our political lives with bloggers who seem to have taken over the mainstream media. You get away with nothing if some blogger, you know, will catch you. I Google myself every day, my assistant. I have no choice. But my assistant and I, Mrs. Freno and I, we both Google me every day. And the darndest things show up. Now, 8 out of 10 of them are wacky. But 2 of them are items that I never would have known about with respect to me. Usually okay. A speech I've given somewhere that was covered locally but not nationally, or somebody saw something about me or read something about me. Every now and then when I'm really, really up to it, and I have to be in a very good mood, I go to YouTube and YouTube myself. This is scary. Because I've been somewhere, I've said something, and there's somebody in the audience hiding behind the person in front of them with a little mini camera or a little phone of some kind recording everything. So this world of transparency is fascinating, and it isn't going to change. It's going to accelerate. And so wealth creation with no longer the cultural, geographic, and ideological boundaries that used to keep us on the red and the blue side of the map, I think is the most powerful force that will be at work politically. The United States does not face any peer competitors that have the capacity to destroy us the way the Soviet Union would have tried to do, or the way Hitler's Germany might have. Those days are over. There are only 3 nations out there that might even dream of doing it and have the industrial capacity to do it, and neither one of them is going to think about it, whether it's China, Russia, or you name somebody else, China, Russia, or India. The only ones with the size. But what are all 3 of them doing? They want to have good relations with the United States. They want to have a partnership with the United States. And the principal partner they want to have is an economic partner. So it is wealth creation that is going to be the driving force that's going to shape the world for better or for worse if the wealth is used badly, if the wealth is used by those who are in improper political situations. A Mugabe with wealth would be a scary person. An Iran with wealth is a troubling country. But wealth is going to be the major factor, wealth creation. With wealth creation comes a better life for people who are using that wealth properly. 300 million Chinese now have come up out of poverty, but there are still 1 billion Chinese who are in poverty, and the Chinese leadership knows it. So they know they have to keep creating wealth. They have to create their own middle class so they can consume their own products. They have to get investment from outside. And they have to take 700 million farmers off the farms where they will never have a better life and get them into industrial areas, get them into cities, and create the infrastructure for those cities. But what does this all take? Energy, which is a second driving force that I think will have a major impact on the vision that you come up with. Because wealth creation requires energy. If you're going to create new factories, if you're going to create new industries, it takes energy. If you start to distribute your wealth and people find that they have a better life, what do they want? We want what we see in television. I want a car. My kid wants 6 electronic gizmos in his room with all the electricity required for it. We want the same kind of middle-class life that you have in the West. And don't lecture us about our use of energy while you are the most profligate user of energy on the face of the earth, Mr. and Mrs. United States of America. So the energy question, which is so real and present today, as we go fill up with our $4.15 a gallon gasoline, at least that's what it was in McLean, Virginia, about an hour ago when I was trying to get down here, this is not going to change, and it is not the result of speculators. It is a result of the huge demand, in my judgment, that is coming up from these countries that are creating wealth and creating a better life for their people. You see, as all of these democracies start to emerge after the Cold War, political democracies will only survive, or at least the incumbents will only survive, if they create a form of economic democracy. I will buy your political democracy as long as I end up with a better life and my children have a better future. And all that will put greater demands on energy than we have seen in the past. And that has to be one of the major factors that you look at. And energy and economic growth are intimately linked. You can also see how it affects other issues, food. I don't have to belabor this point because you can see what is happening with food shortages around the world that are, to some extent, the result of energy problems and energy demand and energy shortages. But also, as people gain wealth, they want a better diet. They want to live better. They want larger portions of food, more protein in their diet. And so make sure that as you shape this vision and decide what you're going to come up with, that you have taken into account the effect of economic growth, wealth creation, the use of energy, and how this affects other issues such as food production and other infrastructure issues associated with growing nations. The other thing that I think has to be an essential part of your vision, and you must discuss this at considerable length, and that's the environment. See how they all connect? We want to create more wealth. We want more cars. Cars take more energy. Cars throw out more emissions that affect our environment. The one finite resource we are working with while we talk about oil and natural gas and solar and wind is the atmosphere. It's finite. And whether you are a true believer in global warming or you still have some scientific doubt in your mind, surely we can do a better job than we're doing now in terms of the emissions that we're throwing into the atmosphere. That is a major part of whatever vision, has to be a major part of whatever vision you come up with. How do you link all these things together? And the fourth one that means so much to us as Americans, and that is taking a great deal of my time and my wife especially as the chairman of America's Promise, and that's the education of our young people. As the world creates this wealth, and as people come up out of subsistence levels, and as economies start to grow, the economies and the individuals in those economies start to move up the ladder of industrialization, they move up the ladder of skills, and education becomes a priority. And when you look at what is happening in so many countries in the world, China is once again a great example. When you see what's happening in these countries, they recognize that and they're investing more and more heavily into their education systems. India is another great example. A country that was on the wrong side of the political ledger from the United States for so many years, now about to be a full strategic partner of the United States. And they also are going to school, a very educated people that are investing even more into educational levels. America, we still have the greatest universities in the world. There's no question about it. We are still the intellectual engine of the world, free world and the not-so-free world. But we have a problem. Too many of our kids do not get that opportunity for a quality education because they drop out. A third of all American youngsters fail to finish high school. Minority kids, blacks and Hispanics, the rate is 50% overall. But the most significant problem is in our urban city areas, where there are cities in America. Detroit comes to mind, and certain parts of Los Angeles, where the dropout rate is 74%. That means 74% of these youngsters coming through the educational system do not get that basic high school education that is an absolutely essential tool to have if you are going to be in this wealth-creating, sophisticated, demanding world requiring more and more intelligence. America has to do something about this, and that's one of the reasons why my wife and I have started this program to have 100 summits around the country to talk about the high school dropout problem. And it isn't that kids drop out in high school so much as that they start dropping out in elementary school. Some states, one western state, can look at the literacy level of a third grader, a third grade cohort, and make a judgment about how many jail cells they're going to need 15 years later. And that's how they do it. The literacy level in third grade will tell you how many jails you're going to need 15 years later. This is a tragedy. It's a crime. It's a huge loss of human potential, human capital that we have in this country. But it's more than that. It's a national security problem. It is an economic problem. Because unless us 300 or so million Americans make the proper investment in all of our youngsters from the time they are born till we get them through the educational system, we are going to be overtaken by billions of people around the world who are investing in their educational systems. And so please include that as part of your deliberations. My summary of this very quickly is economics, the wealth creation engine that is reshaping the world, driven by the collapse of political boundaries that used to keep us separated, driven by the power of the information revolution that gives us the chance to move knowledge and capital, risk and opportunity around the world at the speed of light. How does this affect our energy situation? What do we have to do? Don't we have to get more efficient? Don't we have to conserve? Don't we have to take a hard look at how we are using the energy resources that are available to us? Because it, too, is an economic matter. If energy prices keep going up and the money leaves the United States to go to other countries in the world so that they can lend the money back to us, we had better take a hard look at how we are using our energy. And can't we do a better job? And the answer is yes. And that finite atmosphere, we have to do everything we can to protect. But above all, with all the things I talked about, education is the key. We have to make sure we're bringing along the next generation. Everybody in this room, all the young people in this room, are college graduates, you are all fellows, and you're from some of the great institutions of America. Some of you are here from my own alma mater, the City College of New York. Some of you are Colin Powell fellows from my center, the Colin Powell Center for Policy at CCNY, a place I'm very, very proud of. When I left CCNY 50 years ago, they said, good, go. Take your C average, get into the Army, and maybe they can do something with you. Now I'm considered one of the greatest sons of CCNY. And a center has been named after me, and I'm very proud of it. But I go back to that center frequently. I look at the students at my center at CCNY, 90% minority, 50% were born in another country. Not their parents, they were born in another country. We still are that great immigrant nation. You're going to talk in the panel about where we are in terms of our standing in the world. It's been lowered, as you all know. But you know what? It can be recovered because America is still that great draw. It's that place that people dream about. It's that place that people believe in. As I go around the world and as I go around America on the speaking circuit and talk to lots of groups and lots of associations and companies, I still find a great deal of confidence in America. I find a lot of optimism. Yes, we have problems. There's Iraq, there's Iran, there's Afghanistan. We have other challenges we have to help the world deal with. But for the most part, we're living in a world of relative stability and relative peace. There's no more World War I, II, III, or Holocaust facing this generation. What a great achievement. So we'll deal with the crises of the day and the crises of the moment, but work on finding a vision for the optimistic outcomes of the future. This is a great country. We can be even greater. But it's going to be done by you youngsters. It's going to be done by the generation that comes after you. And all us somewhat older persons can do is give you the benefit of our experience, wish you all the best, and encourage you with all your heart and soul to participate in this project and come up with something at the end of the year and in January, so that you can say to the leadership of America and to the rest of the world, this is what we believe in. This is the vision we have for our country. This is the vision we have for the world. And it's a vision that is built on confidence and optimism that we can achieve anything we set our hearts and minds to, and anything that we dream of. Thank you very much. Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I'd like to. Thank you. 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 I'd like to. We're really here to listen to young people, and I'm only going to take a couple of questions because I want to get to the panel. Yes, sir. You can ask the question. I can pick the answer. So yeah.
General Powell, question about the war on terror. An increasing number of national security scholars in this town are equating the war on terror to a counterinsurgency campaign, or in winning the hearts and minds of those who can join the enemy, in this case, the Muslim world in general, is as important, if not more important, than killing or capturing existing terrorists today. First, how you agree with that assessment. And second, as former Secretary of State, which is the U.S.'s agency of winning hearts and minds around the world, what more do you think the U.S. can do that it's not currently doing?
I think the war on terror, whether that's the correct term for it or not, terrorism is a challenge we face. And I think the United States has to do everything it can using military and police power, hard power, to go after terrorists wherever they may be. We also need to use soft power, and I hope that as part of your discussions you will be balancing hard versus soft power. You need to use soft power to invest in the developing world. I'm pleased that during my term as Secretary, we doubled the amount of development assistance money going to those nations where you might find terrorists, you know, germinating. And so I think we have to do that. I think we also have to speak with a softer voice in our dealings with the rest of the world and listen more carefully to the anxieties of others in the world, listen and hear what others in the world are saying to us. And so I think it is recoverable. And I think that we have to fight terrorism, but at the same time, terrorists cannot defeat our system. Terrorists can do terrible things, as we saw in 9/11. They can perhaps get through and do that again, although we're much safer now than we were then. They may kill some of our fellow citizens. But what they can't do, what no terrorist organization can do, is change the nature of the American system of openness. The greatest strength we have to fight terrorists is to make sure that we remain an open, welcoming society and that we reach out to the rest of the world. We convey a message, as you said, we convey a message to the rest of the world. America believes in its founding values. We are not against any religion. We are not against any country in the world. We are against those who are terrorists, and not any particular religion or sect or part of the world. And America will stand strong against terrorism, but we will not let terrorists change us. We will remain a part of the world. I think I have time for, yes, sir.
Hello, my name is Stan Byers, the Global Fairness Initiative. I'm glad you brought up your last point there. I'm particularly interested in your perspective as a general and former Secretary of State on how the military is looking at combining the four things that you've brought up with what is its approach in dealing with some of the hardest places in the world, and how we can better integrate our policy and decision-making structures internal to government to incorporate all those different aspects of this into better decisions abroad.
Yeah, we need to do a better job of integrating all the elements of power. Secretary of Defense Gates has spoken out strongly about this. You know, you would expect Secretary Gates, as sort of the warlord of America, to always be focusing on the weapons and the soldiers and the sailors and the rest of it. But he's come out very strongly that we need more investment in the State Department. We need more investment in those non-military institutions of the United States government, because if you have strong institutions like that, maybe you can use them to prevent a war from breaking out. Or if a war breaks out and you've used hard power, you have the soft power elements waiting to build on what hard power was. Now, I was once asked at a conference by the former Archbishop of Canterbury, you know, why doesn't America believe in soft power? We do. We do believe in soft power. But, you know, sometimes hard power is necessary. Hitler would not have been susceptible to soft power. And sometimes you have to use hard power and military force. But it is important then, once you have done that, to have other institutions of government, nation-building institutions and other institutions of government, to come in and do the soft power rebuilding. And it is through that effort, frankly, that America has been so successful. After World War II, as you know, and I don't think there's a parallel to Iraq right now, but after World War II, two defeated nations that had coherent societies and were industrialized, we were able not only to bring back quickly, with hard power generals in charge of both places, General Clay and General MacArthur, but put them on a democratic basis, and two of the strongest democracies in the world now after just 50 years of real experience as democracies. So I think you need both. I think the administration understands it, and I'm quite confident the two candidates understand the need for both elements of power. American people have to be prepared to invest in both, not just military, but in all the other institutions, AID, State Department, intelligence assets. I think other departments of government need to also step up to the bar and play a role in it. Now, I'm going to stop right now because it's going to turn to a press conference, and we're really here to listen to the panelists. So thank you very much, John, and it's back to you.
General, you did exactly what we hoped, which was to give everybody the kind of vision for what America could be, just like you've been doing through your whole career. Thank you for that. Okay, Elizabeth, bring your panel up here. We want to introduce you to Next America. Why don't you take it from here, Elizabeth? Are you going to speak from the mic?
Okay. Well, good evening. I'm Liz Sullivan, and I'm the co-director of the Next America Project. And I'd like to thank you all for joining us this evening. General Powell, your remarks were very inspiring. And I am absolutely thrilled that the charge you gave us, I hope, will be fulfilled over the next several months. And we look forward to reporting back to you as we move forward. In a few moments, we're going to be joined on the stage by four outstanding young professionals to really start the conversation, which we hope to carry out for the next several months. But first, I'd like to take a moment and tell you a little bit more about the Next America Project. When Dr. Hamry came to us several months ago with the charge that, you know, our generation should really shape an agenda for Americans' leadership and to recruit 100,000 young professionals, colleagues, and friends to join us in the cause, we knew the web was the right medium. Many of us have grown up with the internet. Many of us communicate every day with our friends and colleagues across the world. We as a generation, we may lack life experiences and have a little bit too much idealism, but we have a global perspective that's different from generations that have come before. Over the next several months, Next America will facilitate a conversation online. Each week, we'll have a new debate topic, and ultimately together, we will determine what our generation's top priorities really are. One of the great things about CSIS is that at any given moment, young professionals will spontaneously erupt in debate. And this effort is really to extend that debate to our generation. We will debate the challenges that face the United States and the international community. We're going to ask difficult questions. Is energy independence a myth? How should the United States define success in Iraq? Should there be a cabinet-level Department of Development? Each week, Next America will pose a critical question online. You can join the debate by logging on, sharing your perspectives, and engaging your peers in a substantive debate. What do you think the top priorities for the next administration really should be? Maybe for you, the most pressing issue is climate change. Maybe it's the possibility of future military engagement. You know, vote on the policy options. Prioritize our challenges, the challenges that we face, and shape an agenda for the 21st century. We will decide on what matters most and shape the best solutions to overcome these challenges. This project will allow us to connect with peers and senior decision makers. Our goal is to bring together students and young professionals from across the country and the world to join the conversation. This is a bipartisan initiative, and all views are welcome. It's not about finding the loudest person in the room. It's about finding the most persuasive. In January 2009, Next America will host a summit on Capitol Hill and roll out your vision for which priorities matter most to our generation. This is a unique time for America and the world. It's a time of great hope and opportunity, and it's also a time of great challenges. It is up to us to determine what matters most, what we can do, and ultimately, it's up to us to begin to act. The success of this effort depends entirely upon you. The quality of the debate, the consideration of opposing viewpoints, the ability to be stretched outside of your comfort zones. All is possible if we open our minds and begin to engage. I hope you will join us to be part of the solution. Log on to nextamerica.csis.org to start to join that conversation. Now, it obviously would have been enough to just hear General Powell's inspirational remarks earlier. But this is really about starting a conversation between us all. I'd like to now welcome on stage four outstanding young professionals. Amar Bashki, Seth Green, Rachel Hoff, and Wes Moore, who are going to help us get the conversation started. You can join me on stage. Let me tell you a little bit more about who these incredible individuals are, and then we're going to start the conversation. And it's really our hope to make this a dynamic and interactive discussion with all of you here. So please join us throughout the conversation. If you have questions, raise your hands. We've got mics. And really, we're going to debate issues, substance, a lot of the issues that General Powell laid out for us here tonight. So please join us. Amar Bashki spent the past year reporting for the online editions of The Washington Post and Newsweek, traveling around the world and looking at how America impacts ordinary lives in a dozen countries. Amar worked with David Ignatius, Fareed Zakaria, as the first editor of Post Global and International Affairs Forum. Seth Green is the founder for Americans for Informed Democracy, a nonpartisan organization that empowers young leaders on over 1,000 campuses to address global challenges. For his leadership in global affairs, he received Search for a Common Grounds Award for International Understanding. Rachel Hoff serves as a writer, researcher, and legislative assistant for Congressman Mac Thornberry. She focuses specifically on foreign policy and national security issues. In 2008, Rachel will serve as the chairman of the Young Republican National Federation Campaign Committee. She was also recently named National Young Republican Woman of the Year and is a leading member of the organization Young Professionals in Foreign Policy. Captain Wesley Moore, currently with Citigroup, is author of the upcoming book entitled Elevate, America's Journey into Manhood. A former White House fellow, Wes served as a special assistant to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. Wes was a paratrooper and captain of the United States Army Reserves and also served a combat tour of duty in Afghanistan. Wes was recently named one of Ebony Magazine's top 30 leaders under 30. Everybody mic'd up? Great. Wes, we'd actually like to start with you. We just heard your bio, and you've accomplished some absolutely incredible things at such a young age. And you know, you've had experience in the private sector and policy arenas and military service, and I think it would be really important for us to hear today about why you decided to serve your country and what that's really meant for you.
Well, first, thank you very much for putting this on. It's fantastic organization and creation, and it's an important initiative as well. Thank you, General Powell, for the opening remarks as well. The reason why I joined the military was actually non-voluntary initially. I actually joined the military, got the concept and the idea of the military when I was 11 years old, and I was sent to a military school in Wayne, Pennsylvania, in the middle of nowhere in Pennsylvania. And that was definitely, it was pretty mandatory. At that point, I had absolutely no choice in the matter. But as I got to the military school, and I realized that the difference that the military made in my life, when I got a chance to go back to my old neighborhoods and see some of my old friends, who years after I had left and going to military school, they were still doing the same type of things they were doing when I left. But I realized that I was evolving. I was changing. I was becoming a different person and becoming a man throughout this process. That's when I finished up high school and I decided that I want to make the military part of my life. that this wasn't just something that I wanted to do for my high school experience. This wasn't something that I wanted to do because it was interesting, but the whole idea of service, the whole idea of leadership, and the whole idea of leadership development that you get from the military was something that I wanted to make part of my core. And so that was really the reason why I chose to join the military. And the when you go out there and you see these young men and women who are serving now, and you're seeing, I mean, literally some of the best and brightest that our nation has to offer, who are putting on the uniform, putting on the boots every single day, that's why I stay. Because it's just such an honor to serve with them. It's such an honor to learn from them. And it's such an honor to be part of their development experience. And you see the important role that the military plays inside of our nation. So that was really the big reason why I decided to join and the big reason why I decided now to stay in.
Fantastic. Amar, you spent a year traveling around the world, you know, asking really critical questions of how America impacts ordinary lives. And what inspired you to take that journey? And what did you discover along the way?
I was doing my senior thesis on Zimbabwe. And I had a run-in with the Zimbabwean government after 6 months in the country. They jailed me for a week, accused me of being a spy for the American government. And I was just doing my senior thesis. And all of a sudden, the fact that I had this connection to America was a big deal. And the guys interrogating me would on one breath say, do you support George Bush and the Iraq War? Very well versed. And on the other say, are all Americans obese? Or are you a celebrity if you're not obese? Funny things like that. Or do I like Michael Moore? I'm into documentary film. So all of a sudden, like, anti-Americanism views of America were very concrete in this very particular place and really have a lot to do with how a very corrupt regime is taking power. Mm-hmm. And for the first time, I really saw just how devastating the consequences of government can be for a place like that. And I came back to the U.S. and was under house arrest from my parents. They didn't want me to travel again because I have a tendency to always travel. And so I had to come up with a great reason. And this topic seemed to me, you know, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, so important. I mean, so many people were concerned about these falling poll numbers and made it look like some, you know, some homogenous reaction. And, you know, the reality is always much more complicated than that. Mm-hmm. And I figured that through new media, through the internet, I could reach out to a new audience who are roughly my age and show them what it's like to live in part in America's shadow or with America's partnership in these different places, get young people interested in lives abroad, and move away from sort of Ahmadinejad said that or Chavez said this to what it's like to be an imam in south of India or a drag queen talk show host in front of millions of Pakistanis and give a real human face to international relations. Because I find with young folks, when you make it clear that, you know, your job, there's outsourcing in your small town in Detroit, your job might be in a place like this, and show them what a small village in China is looking like, or whatever it might be. Suddenly it's real, suddenly there's a connection, and you can leverage social networks, like General Powell was saying, to actually put people in touch. And as their new real-time translation programs, I think there's no limit to the number of connections that can be made. And so this was a small attempt in that direction.
Did you find when you were speaking to people abroad that they had a different perception of young Americans? Or was it all Americans? Or when you were speaking to young people abroad, did their opinions of America writ large differ at all?
I thought that the perceptions of older people abroad, mm-hmm. by and large, was more nuanced and more complex than younger folks. They remembered Watergate as sort of, and with the Washington Post, so they would bring up Watergate. And it's a terrific example of how America as a democracy overthrew leadership in a nonviolent way. And in so many countries, Zimbabwe included, it's a miraculous occurrence. Mm-hmm. With younger folks who have come of age in the past 8 years, sort of in the post-September 11th world, there is more of a conflation, and poll numbers back this up, between the U.S. government and the U.S. people. Older folks will always say, I love the U.S. people, I have some trouble with the government. Younger folks from Lebanon and to Pakistan to the Philippines will, I think, tend to conflate the two more. And I think there are many reasons for that. I sometimes joke that, you know, Paris Hilton isn't Bruce Springsteen, and that's a real... But the pop culture era of the 80s was much more about a liberation, and right now the pop culture is being conflated with the materialism and some of the excesses that people see in America's global stance. Mm-hmm. So I think that makes the task of reaching out to young people abroad all the more urgent and all the more possible because of the web. And I guess I'll just give a quick anecdote now because it's something I think is worth sharing. just in Lebanon, there during the Israel-Palestine war, there were bombs dropping on this 15-year-old boy's house in the south of the country. And he was playing World of Warcraft with a guy named Tom from Kansas. And in the middle of it, you know, he was protected in a bunker of some sort, Beirut full of them, and said, you know, there are real bombs falling outside my house. And Tom writes back, oh man, you know, real bombs suck. Something to that effect. And this boy is 15, his father's high up in Hezbollah. And, you know, you have a case where he is basically telling me with a smile on his face, I know this guy in Kansas wasn't supporting this war. And, you know, it's a tiny blip. It's not going to change anything drastically. But it gives you a sense of what the humor with which this guy, whose father is really hardcore anti-American, can shrug and smile and interact in a way through new media, again, to harp back. So
that's fascinating. Seth, you founded For Americans for Informed Democracy. And I mean, a lot of kind of what Amara's brought up about the ability for young people to communicate on an entirely different level. I mean, what have you really found? I mean, why did you form AID? And really, what is unique about this generation's ability to communicate with each other?
Yeah, well, it's actually for the very reasons that Amara was talking about. I founded AID because I had a post 9/11 experience that really brought my attention to the interconnectedness of our world and the vital role that young people can play through new media and through their experiences abroad in bringing the world back together. Mm-hmm. My experience, just really briefly, was that I went overseas to live for 2 years with Wes, as a matter of fact, just a week and a half after the 9/11 attacks. And it was a very traumatic time for me. My brother was in New York. He ended up being okay, but you know, to see that happen to our country was deeply emotional. And it was my first time living abroad. And I got overseas really thinking people wouldn't be able to understand what I was going through. And I literally would be stopped in the streets of London by people who would hear my American accent, sometimes too loud, and say how grief-stricken they were, outpour solidarity, engage in conversation about what was then called the global war on terror, and how we could rally the world. And this was incredibly heartening. And at the same time, I would come back to the U.S. To visit my girlfriend and see my family. At least my family thought that. I would get all of these people asking me questions. You're abroad. It must be so tough when everyone hates Americans. And I realized that the world that I was seeing was very different than the world that a lot of people here were seeing. Because I was living abroad, having all these collaborative conversations. And people that were watching CNN were following around the 19 individuals who did this. The pockets of hate in the world. And they saw all these threats, but they never got a chance to see the opportunities. And so essentially what we did, and there are a lot of us involved in it, is we had all these conversations, how do we bring this world home? And we realized that study abroad was up 300%. There were students who were taking foreign languages, reading foreign newspapers over the internet, really getting that global perspective. And we decided that young people could be a vehicle for really bringing the world home and helping America to understand that we can solve a lot of these huge threats by working with others. And so instead of just projecting power unilaterally, we could really leverage power. And that's something that I think we have unfortunately learned through mistakes over the last few years, but hopefully the next generation can take the reins back and put our house back in order.
Fantastic. Rachel, you are serving in many capacities, and a lot of them revolve around a young person's role in policymaking today. You know, our generation gets the critique sometimes that we're scared to take a side, that we are keen on consensus, that we are afraid of the political party system, frankly, because it boxes us in too much. You know, you stand out as a leader in a political party. Why did you decide to do what you do and kind of take on that responsibility?
For me, my political identity and my political activity started when I was in college. And when I reflect back, I can see very clearly the links that go back 10 years before that. My first political memories are the fall of the Berlin Wall and Tiananmen Square. And I remember watching these on CNN, and from a very early age, finding myself compelled towards things like the power of the individual in Tiananmen Square, the power of freedom in the case of East Germany. And because in my mind, when I sort of came of age politically when I was in college, there was a party that stood for that, I found a very easy entry point. I think for a growing number of young Americans, they're failing to find that entry point. Whether that's because something in young voters is changing or something in the political parties is changing is up for debate. But I think that as it stands now, if you don't have a philosophy that really compels you towards one or the other political party, you really have a tough go at making a difference. My career in Washington and outside the Beltway, I've worked on political campaigns. I've worked in the policy world, both at a think tank and on Capitol Hill. And I've really been struck by how, as a very young person, I'm able to at least feel like I'm making a difference and that I'm contributing to a cause in which I deeply believe. I think, for people who don't find that, who might identify as independents, which still don't outweigh the number of young people who do identify as either Republican or Democrat if you add them together. But for a growing number of young Americans, they don't have that entry point. And it strikes me that as our generation comes of age politically, without that entry point, whether it's, you know, it's tough to find a job on Capitol Hill if you don't have a Republican or Democrat street cred. It's tough to be elected to office if you look at our government bodies, both inside Washington and at the state and local levels. There just aren't that many elected independents. So if you want to run for office, if you want to do it as a career, it's tough to do as an independent right now. And it strikes me that as we do come of age, something's got to give. And I don't know if that's our generation really finding strong party identity on both sides, I would guess, or a shakeup of our two-party system. I think something's going to change. But the reason I got involved was because, for me, there was a very clear and easy entry point into, in my case, the Republican Party.
Great. You touched on something interesting, and that was kind of the defining moment for you, what those moments really were. A lot of people argue that for our generation, the defining moment was 9/11 and the events that occurred on 9/11. How do people feel about that? Do you agree with that? Do you feel like that's really what was our defining moment?
I know for me, in many cases, it was. And I think also if you look at a lot of people, for example, who I served with in the military, for a lot of them, it was 9/11. Mm-hmm. You know, when I joined the military, it was back in 1996. So, you know, a time of relative peace. And you joined the military because you were looking for, you know, help with college. You joined the military because you found the idea of the military exciting. But it wasn't a situation where you knew you were heading into a wartime environment immediately. Mm-hmm. There are people right now who are going through basic training, and people who went through basic training 5 years ago, you know, throughout until now, knowing that within 6 months of finishing basic training, you could be inside of Fallujah, you can be inside of Baghdad, you can be inside of any other area. And that becomes your prison, that becomes your reality. One thing I did with all my soldiers once we were over there was once we got a chance to get settled and get hunkered down inside of Khost, which is on the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan, which is where we were, you asked them, you said, why are you here? How did you get here? And you'd be amazed the amount of people that said simply one thing, 9/11. This was my call to service. This was my call to act. And so, I mean, at least from my experience, from the experience from a lot of people I know, that was the critical moment for many times where people said, this responsibility is ours. And this mission is much bigger than just ourselves. And therefore, we need to do our part to do more, to really create and define the world that we're going to live in.
How do others feel about them? And Seth, you touched on this a moment ago about 9/11. I mean, do you feel like that's really our generation? I mean, for you personally, obviously, it was very impactful.
Well, I would say that it was an entry point for a lot of our generation because we went through the 90s, which had a very quiet set of issues, quiet in the sense that they were largely trivial. And then you had 9/11, and you had this tremendously important wake-up call. And I think the initial reaction was there's terrorism out there. But then as cameras started going to places like Pakistan and Saudi Arabia, I think young people especially started asking, what's that in the background? Why don't they have development? Why don't they have basic needs met? Why is our energy all coming from one place? And I think the result was that it opened up a set of discussions that were going to come eventually because we need oil and we don't have enough and we need another set of alternatives now, but that I think got fast-forwarded by that process. And I think if you look at technology and what Secretary Powell talked about, wealth creation becoming incredibly interconnected, this was inevitable. But I think if you want to trace it to a moment, 9/11 would be the wake-up call, and it was an entry point for a lot of us to get into these issues. Mm-hmm. And I think we're obviously learning a lot over the last few years. And so I think that 9/11 will ultimately be remembered as a lost opportunity to really engage and win the different fights, but hopefully a lost one that taught us the lessons to ultimately solve our challenges.
That's interesting. I mean, I wonder if we just took a poll here today with our colleagues. I mean, how many of you, by a show of hands, think that this was really that moment for you that, that instigated your passion in foreign policy, or if it was just, you know, that moment that shaped your worldview? I mean, how many people here agree with that? For those of you who aren't raising your hand, is there a moment that you feel really has defined your outlook today? Is there anyone who wants to take a stab and share with us really what you think has been defining?
That's okay.
Go ahead.
Well, for me, it was growing up when I was very young, but during the wars in the Balkans, seeing the headlines and seeing the soldiers rolling through and, you know, seeing the reality of war in the Balkans was what really motivated me to participate in public policy and foreign policy when I got older.
Great, thank you. I think that crowning moment that has such a lasting impact, and for a lot of us, that moment leads to what our passion becomes. And I think Seth, you've articulated that very well. And I wonder if we could go around and say, you know, if you were asked today for the next administration, what your first and top priority really would be, what would that single issue be for you? Amar, what about you? What would that one issue be for you?
Well, I always say climate change and sort of energy independence, one, because it's true and it's kind of the buzzword, and because it's the long-term vision that we have to get right. Mm-hmm. Just in the more immediate term, I would just be concerned that sort of the surge is seen, is kind of making a little bit of a paper tiger on top of the issues between Syria, Lebanon, Iran, you know, Israel, even Afghanistan and Pakistan, that the situations there are continue to be quite tense, you know, and from reports of what you're reading, it looks like, you know, what's going to happen in 3 or 4 years there in terms of the political balance, and what is America's posture going to be? I was just in Dearborn, Michigan, and it's funny because it's a largely Arab population. Most are Christian, but some are Sunni, some are Shia, and the joke kind of that I heard was, you know, around 9/11 times, right afterwards, the Shias were, the government was going to them because Al-Qaeda was Sunni. And then kind of 6-7 years down the road, Iran is a new threat. And so they're going to the Sunnis and saying that the Shia mosques are getting too radicalized. And, you know, so what is that? What does that mean? How are we lumping these groups together? What is our posture towards them? And do we really understand the complexity of that region and sort of how deep our footholds are? So I'd say in the short term that, in the long term, climate change and energy independence.
Wes, how about for you?
And I'll say, I think as General Powell pointed out, it's difficult to isolate one or two mm-hmm. because they all really are very intrinsically interconnected. But I think one thing I think, and again, I'll break it up into some type of way of looking at short-term and long-term. Mm-hmm. I think for the short-term, we've got to look at our economy. And we've got to look at the economics of what's happening inside of, you know, the country. And I say that because of this. When you're looking at the concept of rising oil prices, rising food prices, you know, whether or not we're in a very... The definition of a recession is very technical about growth over a certain amount of quarters. Whether or not we're in a technical recession or not is up for debate. But the fact is we have a lot of people, not only here but abroad, who, because of all these rising prices and a fairly stagnant income levels, are hurting. Mm-hmm. And so you have to come up with some type of solutions, because it's impossible to look at anything from climate change to social services to wars and how we're going to pay for them, whether it be a pullout or whether it be a, you know, redeployment or a deployment, unless you look at how we're going to pay for it. So I think the economy has got to be a central part of the conversation. But I think over the long term, the thing we've got to look at is a concept of national service and a concept of how do we get people involved and engaged, both on a military standpoint, but then also people inside of communities, inside of urban America, rural America, because as was pointed out earlier, you can't look at things happening inside of the United States, for example, 70% dropout rates inside of our schools, and not consider that a larger national security issue, a larger economic issue, not just because of the fact that we'll be paying for them later on because of the prisons and the such you have to build, but what about the brain drain? What about the loss that we now have? Just say, you know, quickly, a book project that I'm working on right now is the one that we spoke about earlier, is really dealing with the day after I received the Rhodes Scholarship that, you know, that sent us over to Oxford. The Baltimore Sun, which is my hometown paper, did a piece on the fact about my childhood and my life. And, you know, I had some challenges when I was younger, but I was able to get this scholarship. The same time, they were doing a piece on four guys who robbed a jewelry store in Baltimore. And one, as they were robbing the jewelry store, it was a smash-and-grab operation. The four of them ran out of the jewelry store. One of them turned around and shot a police officer who was moonlighting as a security guard, shot him three times, two times in the head, one time in the chest, and killed him instantly. And there was a 12-day manhunt for these four guys, and finally they caught them. The reason that this story caught my attention, in addition to, you know, the terrible tragedy of losing the police officer, was one of the guys in particular was from around the same neighborhood I was from, he was around the same age as I was, and his name was also Westmore.
Wow.
So here's the story. Two guys, same neighborhood, same age, same name, very different paths that they ended up taking. He ended up getting life in prison without the possibility of parole. So he's now in Jessup Maximum Security Facility for the rest of his life. And since that, I actually ended up reaching out to him, writing him a note, and just telling him, here's how I heard your story. You know, he actually had four kids before he was 23, and said, you know, I'm praying for your family and for your children. And he ended up writing back. And so for years now, we've had this conversation and gone and visited him over a dozen times, visited his family, his childhood friends, and that was the idea behind the book. The reason I bring that up is this. We have got major issues that we've got to address. And not only do we need everybody involved and engaged in addressing them, but in addition to that, we've got to think about all the people who we could have had engaged who are now out of the picture. And that is the point. That's why I think a larger conversation about national service and getting involved in the lives of kids who are crying for the help and getting them the help that they need is a very important component to where we're going to go as a nation.
Let's talk about this national service idea for a second here, and whether or not national service should be compulsory or if it should be an option or a year abroad or kind of the different models for what that really could look like. I mean, how many people in this audience participate in community service of some kind? Fantastic. How many of you would be willing to take a year off from work between either your high school year or college before professional development?
What if we're professionals but willing to take a year out?
I'll join you. Okay. So, I mean, you see, there's what we're talking about here is a globally minded group of individuals, and over half of you said that you either A, participate in community service today or are willing to take that next step. I mean, what about others? Do you feel like it should be compulsory, if it should be optional with national service? Any opinions?
I think it needs to be optional. I think one of the core elements of service is that is the element of choice. At the same time, Americans are willing to choose to serve.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the many great things about our country. We offer people so many options, whether it's serving in your community, through a faith organization, through a homeless shelter or a soup kitchen, all the way up to, you know, to a lifetime of service like Wes is talking about, and then certainly General Powell in the U.S. military. And then I think what we're figuring out as a nation right now is sort of in between that civilian national service, things like AmeriCorps and Peace Corps, and then other innovations that are going on in terms of providing people more options to choose. But from my perspective, choice has got to be an element of that. But the great thing about America is that we know that people will choose to do it.
Mm-hmm. I think a call to service is absolutely necessary. And I think that one ingredient which we need is an America that this country believes in again.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things that General Powell said was, we can use openness as our key strength. And one of the pieces of that is making sure that all of the ideals that we have are really intact. And I think when the government is going in a very roundabout way on issues like torture, keeping open stations at Guantanamo, it is the rare and very valiant person like Wes who understands service and is still willing to put himself on the line. But I think so many other people lose that sense of faith in the mission because part of what it means to be American is being lost by people who are doing something that I believe is fundamentally un-American. And so when we say we're going to call people to service, I think it's absolutely the right idea. But I think we need to have leadership that really embodies what we are trying to aspire to. Mm-hmm. And when we have that, I think the call will be heard by our generation because we are waiting and anxious. And so many of us are involved in social enterprises and in all these non-governmental institutions. And I think at least part of that is that there has been a poor reputation for the government. And so hopefully we can turn that page, we can restore faith among our generation, and we can get back to showing the world the spirit that I think this country has and hasn't fully been able to showcase.
Fantastic. Let's take a minute here and talk a little bit more about the election process. And young people today are obviously mobilized around these elections. There's unprecedented turnout. You know, the upswing for voter turnout between 18 and 30-year-olds between the 2000 elections and the 2004 was up something 25%, I believe. I mean, what do you all feel as though, I mean, we've talked a little bit about the issues that are going to become important, but also how to become involved. I mean, Rachel, you had mentioned that being part of the political process, part of the party system at least, was inevitable or necessary. And Seth, you've mentioned a few different ways to get involved that may offer alternatives to that as well. I mean, what do you think is going to be the linchpin issue for our generation to become mobilized? Do you think that we are mobilized as a generation over personalities? Or is this about policy and substance? I mean, what is there? And is it going to last beyond November?
I think we're seeing this year kind of a confluence of lots of different reasons for the increase in the youth vote. It is up in huge ways. We have two great candidates, both of whom won the 18 to 29 demographic in their respective primaries and caucuses. So John McCain and Barack Obama both have fantastic stories, and I think are candidates that do reach out in unique ways to young people. On issues, you know, you're seeing the economy consistently tops polls of the most important issue to young Americans. Iraq comes in second. So, there are very serious issues that are being debated and that young people are engaging on through projects like Next America and others. There's a poll that Rock the Vote did that asked young people, the 18 to 29 demographic, why they plan on voting in November. One in every three young Americans said, because it's my duty, my responsibility, or my right. I'm excited about a candidate or party was 6%. So I think that there's, you know, tying into the previous question about this idea of service, there's a sentiment among young people that voting is what we as Americans get to do and have to do. And I think our projects in the world right now and the ways in which we're engaged in spreading that, from the Cold War to now, is something that's really taking root in our generation. I think that's what's underlying the increase in the youth vote. And then obviously great candidates and important issues are augmenting that.
I have a slightly different view because I don't think young people see voting as a right or a responsibility. I think that for most of us, we haven't been very connected to wars and defending our freedom directly. And I think it's left us with a sense of privilege, frankly. I think the reason that we're seeing such a huge optimism among young people and a huge interest in voting is a combination of fear and hope. Fear because of what they have seen. We were told as a generation in 2000 it didn't matter if you voted because the parties were the same. I think that people have a very different view on that now. And I think that people are very afraid of making the wrong choice again. I think that on the hope side, we have two candidates, frankly, who are offering a lot of new ideas and generating a lot of new attention. And I think that combination is leading a lot of people to say, you know what, I have this privilege, I'd better exercise it. And I hope we get back to a point where people see this as a responsibility. I think the call to public service is a part of moving us there. But I think right now we are at an intersection of kind of opportunities. Mm-hmm. And hopefully we can ride this to get to a president that reignites that sense of responsibility.
So you've both taken very different perspectives on what's driving this. But do either of you, or for the rest of the panelists and for the audience for that matter, is it sustainable? I mean, after the elections in November, or after the inauguration in January for that matter, how invested and how involved is our generation going to continue to be?
I'm just going to,
please.
I'm just briefly going to say that I think this is a very pragmatic generation. And part of the ambivalence might have been a somewhat pragmatic assessment in previous years that who was at the top of the ticket wouldn't really affect me if I was doing this job in Detroit or this job down south in Florida. So that's one thing. I think the other thing is part of that pragmatic spirit involves a lot of activity out of the sphere of government, where it's like, you know, I have to be 55 to be in a position of power is the idea, but these social enterprises, I think this is the upside, these social enterprises, these new networks that I can form, I can do things outside the government sphere more effectively, and that place to me seems like it's too complicated and it takes too long. So I think there's both a bad and a good side to the lack of engagement, frankly, that there has been in the political process. The question is really, how do you incorporate the micro-level work of many, many people into the government as a whole, into the organization as a whole, and support it rather than sort of mandate it and dictate it? That's sort of where I come at this, that to the extent that the government can enable and encourage small enterprises and these sort of good works among people across the country, it seems to me like a very American idea, the idea of spurring people to do good and at the same time do well, you know, and I think that that's something that is very much a part of this generation, the idea that you can do the two simultaneously, both at home and abroad. And one thing I'd say is when you're trying to turn it to foreign policy, when you're trying to get young people interested in the rest of the world, it's one thing to say, look, there are thousands of starving people. And I think that, you know, that can be overdone. And there's room for a young filmmaker to say, look, I'm going to make a reality TV show that's going to bring you from Morocco to, you know, Cape Town over the course of a year, and we're gonna make money out of this. We're gonna have fun. We're gonna build in new people in this enterprise. So I think it's a whole mindset that can be in the government, outside of the government, that it can be profitable. We can engage in new ways, and I think the real challenge for us is sort of what can you do? How can we contribute to this and encourage it, rather than play on some emotions that might not be as, that might be playing to something that closer to a guilt sensation.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's a good point. I think also one thing we can't forget is the importance of technology in all of this.
Absolutely.
I mean, the ability to go out and reach literally people, not just people from your neighborhoods or from your states or even from your country, but from around the world in an instant's notice. That is something that needs to be factored into not only the ability to create the buzz and the excitement that we have now, but also the sustainability factor. And the fact that this generation growing up now, this is a global generation, make no mistake about it. They have friends from all over the world that they're communicating with online. Mm-hmm. They understand things that are happening around the world. I mean, quite honestly, even if you want to look at the phenomenon that we know as you know, Senator Barack Obama and what has happened, if it were not for technology and his ability to really mobilize technology, we would not have Barack Obama as the nominee for the party. Mm-hmm. So we have to understand the importance that technology is now playing into the entire political process, but also into the entire process of social entrepreneurship, the process of nonprofits, and everything that's happening within the country and within the world right now. Because that's something that it's new and it's unique and has been the ultimate, has been the ultimate equalizer in the how we view different things and how a world prism is viewed.
Yeah, just really brief, in West Virginia, the Obama campaign, I was reporting on race and the issue of the Obama campaign merging with the Democratic headquarters, which has traditionally been run by 12 union laborers who are white and have been there for a long time, decades. And now there are 50 Obama volunteers, you know, of all races in a small minority, in a 3% African-American town. And it's completely revolutionizing the Democratic headquarters, the structure of power in that place that has been in place for three or four decades. And there are two points there. One is, you know, the way he's harnessed new media is not just we collect online, but we connect online and then we meet in person. Even while I was reporting, you know, you say, give me your ideas, and you say, look, I'm in Turkey, I'm in Istanbul, why don't we meet up for coffee? And you get a bunch of people to meet up for coffee, and it spreads like that. And that, I think, is part of how new media can take a real position on the ground and change institutions and structures of power in a very concrete way.
Mm-hmm. This issue of technology and new media, kind of melding worlds, I mean, we are an information-rich society, but we all are processing information in very different ways. I mean, we can go on the internet and go to our favorite websites, check our favorite blogs, and never really see the other side. Whereas this has been a pretty interesting transition for our generation, and we process information very differently. I mean, I think several of you have experience with blogging. How do you think that's really impacting how our generation makes decisions and how we really process information? Are we getting the full spectrum, or are we pick and choosing our media?
Well, if I can say one thing about technology, our nonprofit organization uses video conferencing. And we have found the ability for that to break down barriers has been just totally unique. So when we were getting started, we had this mindset that had been groomed from our experiences abroad. We wanted to bring that home and tell people about all these opportunities. And we'd come back and we'd try to, you know, share all of our insights. And it's very hard if your facts don't fit the frame of the person that you're speaking to change people's minds, because they think that you have an agenda and you're just saying something because you want them to come over to your view. And so we said, you know, instead of trying to be pedagogical and try to impose our views, we're just going to set up video conferences. And we're going to have peers in different parts of the world, let's say Indonesia, talk with people on these university campuses and the young professionals in the area. And one of our first ones was a video conference that Northwestern students did with a group of women at the Quranic Studies Institute in Indonesia. And Indonesia, predominantly Muslim, has a female prime minister and has a group of women who spoke with our students who are as feminist and assertive as it comes. And a lot of people walked in there with certain views about Islam and how it doesn't fit with democracy and it doesn't fit with women's rights and all of these things. And we could have lectured about, you know, there are all these things, we've met these people, and it would have turned everyone off. And they walk in there, and they're just all looking at the screen saying, wow, those women are Muslim, they're in Indonesia, and boy, are they feisty. And they have all of these views. And I'll tell you, the power of that medium, we called it a mini study abroad, because that's what happened to us. And for us to be able to share that experience through technology gave us all the power, so to speak, in the world to change minds.
Fantastic. You know, Next America is really an initiative about using technology to start this conversation across the country, across the world, to talk about substance. And to take it back to kind of foreign policy and what we were talking about a little bit before about our priorities as an for the next administration, you know, we're launching this week with a debate on energy and energy independence. I mean, General Powell, you talked about this being one of the most important issues that our generation really faces and that our country faces. You know, is energy independence a myth? And that's kind of the premise of the debate that we're starting. And if we took a straw poll here, I mean, how many of you would say energy independence or the U.S.'s pursuit of it is a myth, or it's even not accomplishable? How many of you would say that it's a worthy goal of the U.S. pursuing? So we have about a 50-50 split when it really comes down to it, and I wonder if anyone would like to address that issue and really start to take a substantive debate here today. What's your answer?
Well, I just wanted to say something quickly.
Yeah.
General Powell was talking about the idea of finite resources. One thing that we also know is a finite resource is fossil fuels.
Mm-hmm.
There will become a point when we are no longer able to rely solely on fossil fuels. And not only because, again, there's a finite amount of fossil fuel resources that we can tap into, but in addition to that, when you have a rising population and you have a declining resource, what's going to happen is that it's going to come to a price point that no one's going to be willing to pay for it anymore. And we've already come to a point where you can pretty much do almost anything right now without oil, without type of fossil fuels, whether you're using solar, whether you're using wind, whether you're using switchgrass, wood chips, whatever the case might be. So the question has always been, what is the price point? How can we get it to where it's going to be level with how much you're going to pay for oil? Because as of right now, that's still by far the cheapest resource in order to garner massive amounts of energy. But if you simply look at it from that perspective, for the fact that, again, we're dealing with a finite resource, alternative sources of energy has got to become part of the equation. simply because with a rising population and rising energy needs, as was spoken about earlier, you're going to have to come up with alternatives on how you're giving this population the energy resources that they need. Mm-hmm. So whether you buy into the global warming argument, whether you buy into the, you know, the it's not sustainable argument, we know that these have to become part of the equation simply for sustainability reasons. Mm-hmm.
And if I can,
go ahead.
No, if you want to go to the audience, go for it.
We'll take you, Seth, and then we'll go to the audience.
Okay, if I can just add to Wes's point, it's absolutely a price point. And the government should be playing a role in helping make that price choice easier for us, because the externalities of oil in terms of our dependence and the volatility it creates in markets are huge. We are seeing that now. And until now, the government has actually subsidized the oil companies. So we have made the price point easier on the oil side. And what we can do is we can either tax oil, which is going to be very unpopular, or we can begin investing in all of these alternative technologies. Obama has put out a huge plan, more than we put into getting men to the moon to do that. McCain has come up with a plan as well, not quite as large. So it looks like this is in the future. But what we really need is that kind of investment, because we should be speeding up to the price point. It is a travesty we've come to this point with no government help. It hopefully will be solved in the future.
Sarah, did you want to speak? Sarah's actually helping kick off our debate online, so you'll have to tune into the website to check out her written statement as well.
My name is Sarah Mincheski. I work for the Defense Department on a sustainable energy program called the Energy Conversation, and once a month we hold a public discussion that's interagency, intergenerational, interdisciplinary, where we're looking at all of the technologies that are going to be needed to address the increased demand for energy in this country and abroad. And I think one of the reasons we might have a 50-50 split on this energy independence issue is that it hasn't been clearly defined by any of the politicians in public discussion. Taken literally, we cannot supply the demand required in this country on our own. We're increasingly interdependent and on a global economies. So we need to look at a lot of different technologies that are going to help solve this problem. And I'm so glad General Powell brought up the idea or the connections between wealth creation, energy, food production, and infrastructure, because it's really going to take an understanding of how, when we shift towards ethanol, how that's going to be impacting food prices around the world. And we can't start throwing money at the problem politically without really thinking through how these policies are going to play out on a global scale. So I think one thing that we can do as a younger generation that would be extremely valuable would be to define what energy independence really means. And I think what energy really means, and what I kind of wrote up for this discussion, is that it can create the geopolitical environment where we start weighing out all of the consequences involved with the decisions we make regarding what we choose to call energy independence. So,
thanks.
And I'd be curious to know what all your thoughts are and how we begin to define energy independence.
Fantastic. One of the issues that Sarah's raised, and I think the panelists have talked about with the energy independence issue too, is when does a term that become more politically viable, and kind of what is the means by which we should start to define a problem and start to break that problem down. I mean, do people think that even if energy independence is a myth, if we accept that as a given, what leverage points do we neglect then by not being able to leverage additional resources for new technologies or innovation? I mean, do people think that that's a trade-off? Or kind of what would your response be to that argument? Does anyone want to take that on?
Chime in. I think speaking about whether or not energy independence is something that's viable or not is first of all kind of a discussion about the numbers. So there's kind of, I think we have inertia in the transportation system, right? We have we're importing like 13 million barrels a day, and we just simply, you know, can't produce what we consume. So there's all this inertia in the transportation system. And I think moving to energy independence, even though the price of oil right now is very high, kind of going to some of the technologies that are starting to become available, it's very, very expensive, and it'll cost us a lot. But I think more importantly, as we've heard with a lot of the discussion today, we live in this interconnected world, and energy markets are global. And so I think we're really trying to, energy independence is an attempt to kind of define some of our goals. We want energy to be reliable, affordable, and clean. And so I think that really we're talking about another kind of goal. Maybe that's something like energy security, which is something that we kind of look at globally. And there are certain kinds of things that we can do, you know, promoting free markets, open access, international cooperation, which can enhance energy security for us and for the rest of the world as well. So I think that maybe we're getting a bit confused with energy independence.
Great. Thank you so much. Well, this is precisely the type of debate that we want to stimulate with that, the Next America website, and with events like these to follow as well. So I'd like to thank the panelists and you as well, all the audience members, for participating with us today. And I really do hope that you'll want to become part of the conversation. So thank you so much.
You could make that a movie, man.
That was an amazing story. I haven't heard it before. That was good.